Our next case this morning is 2019-395, the State of Ohio versus Haywood Jones. For the appellant, Mr. Coca.
Good morning, Justice of the House Supreme Court. My name is James Coca. I'll be representing Haywood Jones this morning. Counsel, that is my co-counsel seated at trial table, is Patrick Milligan. The proposition we are here to discuss today is whether the trial court's failure to make standby counsel available during voir dire constitutes structural error, is deemed prejudicial per se, and requires automatic reversal because it deprives a defendant of the right to counsel at a critical stage of trial. In this particular matter, justices, we are dealing with two separate indictments. There was over 100 counts in the separate indictments, 405 counts, and we were dealing with trafficking, conspiracy, and other complicated legal issues that Mr. Jones was facing in these particular matters.
Counsel, I wonder if we could just jump to the first legal question, and that is there a constitutional right to stand by counsel?
So I don't believe there's a clear line on a constitutional right to stand by counsel. However, there has been times that it has been determined that standby counsel is necessary. Certainly in Feretta, it has been found that standby counsel is appropriate through the U.S. case, and then through State of Ohio in Martin, that is stated that you have the right to counsel, or you have the right to be pro se with standby counsel available.
But so, is that the same? You said it's appropriate, it's necessary, it's a great idea. Is that the same as a constitutional right to stand by counsel?
I don't believe there is. I believe, as the amicus brief states, there is no clear rule that states there is a constitutional right to stand by counsel.
So,
I think
can a trial court deny outright standby counsel for a pro se litigant?
I believe the trial court counsel does have the, I'm sorry, the trial court does have the ability to deny.
So if the trial court does not deny and provides standby counsel, that standby counsel is necessary at every stage, including voir dire.
I do believe there needs to be some more guidance, as the amicus brief does states on that particular, but that would be our argument. That would be correct. I believe that when it's determined that standby counsel is required, this more clear guidance is necessary. However, there is case precedence that during these critical stages, it is necessary. And by not having that trial counsel available at those critical stages, structural error does occur.
Counsel, was it argued down below that the denial of standby counsel under this particular set of facts was just an abuse of discretion in this particular case?
In this particular case, I believe they tried to go under the plain error test here and basically said that since there was no objection to this particular line here, that they needed to go under the plain error test. The dissent in Judge Jensen obviously found that there was a proper objection made in this case due to the fact that Mr. Jones had on several occasions requested to have counsel.
Trial courts often encounter difficult defendants who discharge their attorneys, and then 10 minutes later they want their attorneys back, and then they want to discharge them. I mean, there has to be a point where a trial court draws a line. Would you agree?
I certainly would agree. And where I think this case differentiates is this individual did initially want to waive his counsel, although there's a bit of an unclear record as far as how that occurred.
Why is that? I read that in the Court of Appeals presumed regularity in the waiver. Where's the record as to the waiver?
Your Honor, it appears that that particular record, there was issues getting that from the court at the appellate level. We had been able to receive that, but not until late in time, and there was a supplemental brief that was filed with regard to that. We still find issue with that waiver, although that is not before us today, but apparently there was an error with regard to getting that record at the time. And so due to their issue there, the no irregularity was presumed at this point. I think our case is unique in that each of the cases that we have looked at, including the recent 8th District cases, the individual waived counsel, did not want counsel. And it was only through the fact that there was appeals and looking at, well, did they have the right to have that standby counsel available, that this occurred. In our particular matter here with Mr. Jones, he did initially waive and then came back and said, you know what, I don't know what I'm doing here. This is a very complicated matter. There's over 100 counts. I don't understand what I'm doing in the process, and I would like counsel. The judge in this case then went back and said, well, we are not going to give you new counsel. We stand by counsel, the same individual that we had initially appointed to you. The problem that
Didn't he say then it's not going to be available for voir dire, but it'll be available after voir dire?
He did say that.
How is that justified?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. I believe that this counsel that is standby should be available at all of these important...
So if the judge had said you can't have standby counsel at all, I presume that would be okay, right?
There is no line that certainly would have changed the circumstance, Your Honor. And it would have certainly
There's no right to count. I mean, we don't have the issue before us of whether he waived his right to counsel. We know there's no right to standby counsel, so that's it for everything else. So the error was allowing there to be counsel for the rest, standby counsel for the rest of the trial?
So we believe that there
or not
is...
not giving counsel at voir dire.
We believe that there is an inherent fairness in looking at situations like this where a judge would look at a case and say, you know what, you're going to need standby counsel. I don't think that you can navigate these waters by yourself.
Well, this brings me then to my question. Your argument seems to be it really is an all or nothing proposition. The trial court can give standby counsel or can refuse to give standby counsel. It is at the discretion of the court. Is that correct?
It appears to be at the discretion of the court at this time.
And then, of course, it could go up on appeal where an appellate court might say that discretion was abused.
Yes, correct.
But herein lies the problem. If at some point a defendant goes on pro se and midway through, I didn't have standby counsel at voir dire. I only got standby counsel midway through.
Well, and we certainly have seen that in Robinson and in Hardman, Your Honor, where that has been an issue, and they have determined that counsel at those stages are one of the critical stages in denying that would be an issue, or even failing to have the discussion as to whether or not standby counsel would be available for those would be reversible error. What we would be asking would be what the amicus brief has sort of referenced in this particular matter, and we would be asking for the court to draw those lines instead of potentially the legislator. I think that in the interest of fairness, as this panel has always looked at, when an individual repeatedly states, I don't know what I'm doing, when he starts voir dire and says, I don't know what to do, it seems that we're working against the interest of justice.
So here's what I'm confused about, though. Our proposition says that the right to standby counsel, that the failure to provide standby counsel at all stages is a structural error, prejudice is presumed. I can see why you and the Amicus Association would want us to provide guidance, and maybe that is a good idea, but I don't see how, doesn't that lead us then to the answer that this is not structural error?
I don't believe it.
So help me understand your structural error.
I believe that we have inferred a bit of a Sixth Amendment protection here. In this particular matter, Mr. Jones was at one point given the same attorney, said, you know what, I think I'm going to go at this myself, and then had done the waiver, at some point decided I cannot do this. When the judge in this matter said, you know what, we're going to give you standby counsel, I think that created a reliance in Mr. Jones and in any defendant who would be in that particular matter, especially when a defendant is saying, no, I've got this. I know what I'm doing. In his case, he's saying, I don't have this.
How is there reliance over here? How is there reliance if he says you get standby counsel, just not for voir dire?
Well, I think where he's...
How is there reliance on voir dire?
Well, when we've all started a trial, and, when a defendant's sitting there has never been through this, when a young lawyer's done it and voir dire begins, that's your first opportunity to sit there and start your trial and begin to speak with the individuals that would be deciding your fate and be able to start to frame your trial. As we well know, as trial attorneys, voir dire is a critical stage in that particular process. As he's standing there alone without the individual he's been instructed will be put beside him, he's denied that ability. And he's been denied that ability to properly navigate that. Case law has stated that standby counsel is there to help you with basic principles and concepts.
Well,
and
counsel, did the judge take the role of standby counsel for voir dire? Didn't he start instructing Mr. Jones about voir dire?
I do believe that occurred, Your Honor, and I do believe that Mr. Jones continued to...
Well, I'm not saying that's good enough. I'm just wondering,
He did, Your Honor.
Yeah, and in fact, I wonder, was that the role of the judge? Is he blurring his role there by saying, well, I'm not going to, you know, bring your standby here, but here's how voir dire works.
Judge, I've always sort of agreed with that. And as an individual that tries cases, I like to have control of my own voir dire. And that's always been an issue we deal with at times, that certain judges like to be more intensive with their involvement there. In this particular matter, I do believe that blurs that line. And I do believe that Mr. Jones would have been benefited by having that standby counsel where he could ask him, what sort of questions do I ask? And what are the theories here? How do I go about doing this? And he didn't have that resource available to him, as you stated. The judge sort of instructed him through that as he was still blindly confused.
Counsel, didn't your client bring some of this on himself?
He did, Your Honor.
Maybe all of this on himself, where he admitted to the trial court, I was just stalling. I was just stalling for time. I really do want counsel. I mean, what's a trial court supposed to do in that situation where you've got a defendant potentially playing games?
And Judge, I've been through this myself in different circumstances where there is a defendant who is new to the process or is difficult in the process. And as the amicus brief states, there are many situations that we go through here. I think that we have a duty, especially in a case as complicated as 100 different counts with some of these concepts, to do everything we can to protect the defendant and his rights to a fair trial. And I think in this matter, it's clear through the motions that Mr. Jones had filed for new counsel, through the representations he had made, I don't know what I'm doing, through his standby counsel saying he's asking for new counsel, the prosecutor does not object to it. I think we need to go a little further. I think that some sort of colloquy on the record to state, look, you've rescinded this waiver, this is it, you know, you're going to go forward, we can give you a trial in 60 days, 30 days without there being any error. There's not an indication this was one of those cases. There was four or five lawyers that had been going on for an excessive period of time, but I certainly do understand the problem of the delay with regard to, and certainly Mr. Jones did create some of his problems here.
If he invited the error, whether it's structural, plain, or harmless, why does it matter?
Because I believe at the point that the judge determined he really couldn't do this by himself and gave him standby counsel, I think there was an error there inherently. And I think then to deny him through all critical stages that which he had just given him sort of created a disaster and a mess for us, leading us down to this road today. I think on a plain reading of this, everyone can see that Mr. Jones had no way of taking himself through this trial by himself. And certainly we are down to now looking at, we've given you this standby counsel, but we didn't prepare him for your voir dire, which we believe a critical stage.
But then the court could have just said, you can't represent yourself, I'm appointing counsel.
The court does have the ability to do that, Your Honor. Unfortunately, we don't like that.
So the court was trying to accommodate the defendant, Mr. Jones.
I believe that the court did not accommodate Mr. Jones in this matter. I believe the court should have looked at this and said, Mr. Jones, you did make a mistake. We are going to either reappoint this counsel for you or another counsel to deal with this matter, this complicated matter. I think that the court took a half measure by giving standby counsel, and in doing so potentially opened a door.
Half measure invited by your client?
To some degree, yes, Your Honor.
Is this a case where really we have the wrong issue in front of us? Isn't the real issue here whether once someone waives their right to counsel, if they can ever ask for an attorney again? I mean, isn't that what we really should be deciding then?
Well, and certainly we had raised that issue, which is not before the court today. But I think that the two can interplay back and forth. As the case law out of the 8th District has cited, the waiver as well as the once you do that valid waiver, they still can find and still have found reversal based upon the fact that you were denied that access to or instruction to that ability to have that standby counsel. So what we are asking this court to do is find that in a complicated matter such as this, we need more clear rules, and certainly when that standby counsel was put there, there was a presumption or sort of an inferred right there. That individual believed he would have counsel with him at trial table through all stages.
You say we need more clear rules. Is that something that really we should do through the rulemaking process? I really struggle with the idea that if there's no right to counsel, then how can there be a right to counsel?
And I certainly understand that, and I believe we have a little bit of a reliance issue here, Your Honor, that we can potentially legislate and create some rules, some hard and fast rules to help clean this up a little bit. I don't think that there's any better body than the Ohio Supreme Court to do that. And I think in doing so, the defense bar would be helped by having that clear understanding and the role that getting proper representation for individuals in cases such as this could certainly be helped, and there would be no blurry lines at that point.
The defendant didn't ask for standby counsel. It was given by the court.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the whole concept of a standby counsel is a court-created half measure that supposedly, I guess, the intent is to breach, the chasm between having full representation and pro se representation. And this is maybe thought to be able to deprive the defendant then of saying, I didn't have a counsel, and so all these mistakes I made or all the errors is attributed to the fact that I didn't have counsel, or any kind of flaw in a waiver of counsel, because you've got a standby counsel, so that's going to take care of that. But again, we go back to either you're going to appoint standby counsel or you're not, and it's going to be for all the critical stages of the proceedings, or it's not. And isn't that the problem that we have?
Your Honor, I certainly think that that would make things clear, the issue of quite nicely, if either we are going to do it or we are not going to do it in situations where you're pro se. Certainly in Martin, it says that they are going to do that, and certainly in Chronic, it infers that. While we have that available, it would help to then say, if we do this, then these are the critical stages that this needs to be done, and this is the role of that standby counsel. Otherwise, we have a number of different situations where this could arise, such as this, with confusion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kearney.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. Nothing we've heard so far changes the simple two-step logic that defeats Jones's claim. Step one, the Sixth Amendment does not grant a right to standby counsel at all when a defendant chooses self-representation. We know that from precedent and from Jones's own admission. Step two, without that underlying right to counsel, there can't be any conditional or residual right to have standby counsel give effective assistance or perform in any particular way.
What's the point of standby counsel?
Well, Your Honor, it's not a matter of right, but if Ferretta says permission, Martin also says it's permitted. It's basically the court being paternalistic and saying, we know you have this right, but it's a really bad idea, so we're going to offer this to at least maybe minimize your self-harm. But when we do that,
it's for the protection of the defendant.
It is for protection, but it's not a right, because what this court plainly said in Martin, and I respectfully disagree with my friend on the other side, who on the one hand admits it's not a constitutional right, but then says at other points there's no clear rule. There is a clear rule. Martin says once you choose the path of self-representation, that, quote, those rights are independent of each other and may not be asserted simultaneously. You can't be down the right to counsel
path. That's not what the syllabus of Martin says. Syllabus says in Ohio a criminal defendant has the right to representation by counsel, or to proceed pro se with the assistance of standby counsel.
Word for word. It's true. That language from paragraph 32 says that loosely, and if that were the only sentence, I could see how.
I'm reading from the first sentence of the syllabus.
That's true, but.
Am I bound by that?
You're bound by the entire case, Your Honor, because the reasoning says that the two rights cannot be exercised simultaneously, and it also says that it is optional, that it's permitted. But there's more. In Obermiller, this court said you don't even have to tell the defendant about the right to standby counsel. If that's part of the package on Path B, you would at least have to tell them. Moreover, I note that he's not even raising an argument that the Ohio Constitution is any different here from the federal one, so we are under the Sixth Amendment standard. And every federal court and every state Supreme Court to look at the issue has said not only that there's no right to counsel, but has also gone on to step two and said, without a right to counsel, there can be no ineffective assistance claim.
So I don't care about the Ohio Constitution that says in any trial in any court, the party accused shall be allowed to appear and defend in person and with counsel.
Correct, because first, I note that he doesn't raise a claim that the Ohio Constitution is different. Also, if you look at some of the other cases, Nebraska's Supreme Court did a very nice job in the Gunther case. I believe Connecticut and Gethers and Michigan and Denny all looked at state constitutional claims as well. One of those had that identical language with the and said, but these two rights are, you have this and this right, but you can't do them simultaneously. So for this court to find that as a matter of Sixth Amendment would be disagreeing with all of the federal courts, which have said you can't have an ineffective assistance claim. Now, I want to note something important about chronic and structural error. It's not as if you have an ineffective assistance claim under Strickland over here and a chronic structural error claim over there. No, all of those claims, chronic is a subset of ineffective assistance claims. What you have is one claim, ineffective assistance under your Sixth Amendment right, and you have two evidentiary paths. Under Strickland, you show deficient performance, and then you show prejudice. Under chronic, we give a shortcut, and we say, when someone's outright missing, they go out to lunch during a witness, and they say, I'll be right back, that is presumed prejudicial, and so you get a pass on having to show prejudice, but it's still a form of ineffective assistance.
Counsel, you had no objection to the defendant's request at the trial court level for this for standby counsel, right?
Correct. That's because we know it's a matter of grace from the court.
Right. So I presume because he had no objection, there was no presumed prejudice from the state. It may have delayed the trial from proceeding a day or so?
No, there had actually been, first, when he said, I want to represent myself, they did kick the trial back several months.
Okay.
Then, when at the last minute he said, I want to get back to counsel, he wanted another delay, and then the judge said, enough is enough. This has been hanging on for a year now.
No objection to that request,
correct,
right?
We don't object to standby counsel, but we do object to making it a right.
Okay.
Because there's no doctrinal root for it. It's also bad policy and impractical. Not that that should overcome the lack of any doctrinal root here, but note that under McCaskill, the U.S. Supreme Court says if you are too active and you start doing too much, that violates the right to self-representation. Well, that's fine on one hand. Don't go too far in being active in standby counsel. But if you also say, but you can't be too inactive, you have to do just enough to be there, or you have to give good advice, you can't give bad advice, whispering in his ear, then all of a sudden you're now hemmed in where you're unconstitutional if you do too little or too much, and that gives the court an incentive to not give standby counsel at all.
Mr. Carney, let's say for the sake of argument, we agree with you, there's no constitutional right to standby counsel, it's grace from the court. And you're arguing here about the ineffectiveness claim one way or the other, too much or too little, can't we fashion a rule that says if a trial court, and we agree that there's no right to standby counsel, but if a trial court agrees to appoint standby counsel, that there are some parameters with regard to that? And so in other words, would it be reasonable for trial court to say you can have trial court counsel when it's your turn to present evidence, but not when it's the other side's?
Well, two problems with that, Your Honor. First, of course, the court could write a rule like that in its rulemaking capacity. And that's why for a lot of rights, for example, the colloquy to waive under Rule 44 for counsel or under Rule 11 for a guilty plea, this court supplements the baseline constitutional rights by creating rules telling a court do this and that. And that's why the court's jurisprudence says some errors are constitutional, some are rule-based. So for rule-based, you need prejudice and you can waive in a different way. You know, there are all these structures that go around actual rulemaking. But if you try to design something now, the problem is what's it rooted in? If it's not rooted in the Sixth Amendment, it's just rooted in it's a good idea. But it's not a good idea to simply make up things with no doctrine. And if you call it Sixth Amendment, then that is a federal law problem. If you call it the Ohio Constitution, you've got no showing, not even an allegation, that the Ohio Constitution's original meaning or text or evolution means anything different from the federal one.
Counsel, shouldn't we just send this matter back to the Court of Appeals over here, I'm sorry? And now that we have the record that they didn't have about the waiver, they can look at that and ask them to analyze the situation under whether this was an abuse of discretion, especially because you had no objection and he was denied this very...
Not at all, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. First, as to the extra trying to find stuff later, There was no request for it, as the Sixth District notes in his opinion, and so that was a choice made by appellate counsel below. So trying to switch that up at this court would simply reward and incentivize other claimants in this court to try to make up. If he's got a problem with what his actual counsel did, it was a different appellate counsel in the Sixth District, not my friend on the other side. But whether he's got a remedy for that or not, I don't want to give a roadmap for someone else, but that's other remedies. This court should not address issues that were not granted review, not even sought on review, on evidence that was not sought below, and just give somebody a do-over. That would invite all sorts of havoc. Also, the abuse of discretion standard, keep in mind, every time you look at abuse of discretion, you're saying discretion under what? The discretion given you under Rule 44 or the discretion given you under a statute. Abuse of discretion doesn't just exist in a vacuum. You have to have discretion granted. And here, there is no constitutional basis to provide any boundary for this.
But even if we accept that, I mean, Judge Jensen in the dissenting opinion had real trouble with the fact that, you know, the defendant admitted, yes, I was trying to get private counsel, I couldn't afford it. I don't know what I'm doing here right now. I'm having really difficulty. I need some help.
Right. Well,
you had no objection.
That later colloquy where he talks about, I want to take it back, that doesn't go to the initial waiver, which is the missing transcript and the late motion last week. That goes to attempting to revoke and get yet another extension of the trial date later in November. The first one was August, there was another hearing in September, and then this last one in November where he said, I was kidding all along, I was just trying to buy time. That's how I thought I could buy time. I thought my cousin would buy me a lawyer. That didn't work out. All of that happened in November, and that's about the right to revoke counsel, and that was in the propositional law that this court chose not to grant. If this court wanted to, you know, could have sought reconsideration at the jurisdictional stage, says these are so intertwined, and this court has granted that sometimes, that on a motion for reconsideration, you add counts back in or propositions back in. But once this court has rejected it, we shouldn't just switch gears and give a free vacatur of a conviction here. I want to mention two or three other things quickly, if I may, that counsel referred to on the equities or facts here, which I think should not matter because this is a straight legal issue. You know, what if you have a defendant who's never been through it and doesn't know how this works? As the judge noted in saying, I think you're playing games, you've been through this before, this is a defendant who had had three prior felony trials and prison terms of 4 year, 2 year, and 1 year, including for complicated four drugs. He'd had a couple of...
Did he have an attorney?
In those other cases, yes, but he had obviously been through...
It wasn't all due to his failures that he was...
Correct, correct. He was counseled, I believe, in those other cases.
So you're saying he should have picked up on how many peremptories he should have had?
I'm not sure, but he'd been through more trials than, honestly, I have. But the other thing is that we often give in other areas. We do give, for example, if the state funds legal aid or the state creates a statute where people in certain situations, I know the court has another case about, you know, child custody, there are times where the court or where the legislature or the system gives counsel. And if that counsel messes up, you might have a collateral claim for malpractice, you might have an ethics complaint against that lawyer, but you don't have an effective assistance counsel claim. Why? Because that's a unique Sixth Amendment right for criminal trials. And once you waive that, again, you know, Yogi Berra said, when you see a fork in the road, take it. But what this court says in Martin is, no, sorry, we don't adopt the Yogi Berra theory. Once you go down this path and you go down self-representation, you can't cherry pick pieces of that other path. Just like if you say, I'm going to have a bench trial.
He's chose one path with a waiver of counsel, and then standby was imposed upon him by the court, and that changes the game.
Well, no, Your Honor, it doesn't, because first, he did not object to that. This court has never addressed what I think would be a separate question of, can you impose a standby counsel if someone says, no, 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 I don't want him. In fact, he actually asked him, would you like him to sit at the back of the room, like has happened in other cases, to literally be standby, so if you have to jump back into the driver's seat if the judge withdraws the right of self-representation from you, or do you want him to sit and be advisory counsel? And Jones chose to have him at the table. So he could have said, you know, I don't want him in the back of the room versus, you know, stay home six blocks away. It doesn't really matter.
So he said, I want him at the table.
Yes, he chose that. So
his certain reliance on the standby counsel status?
No, it's not reliance, Your Honor. Now, I'll grant that the Eighth Circuit's or Eighth District's concern in Robinson and Hardman, there might be at the outer limit a problem with knowing an intelligent waiver if you actually had it in the initial waiver. If you said, well, I'm not sure I want to waive, and you say, well, if you do, I would give you this. If there were a promise, like if you do, I'll move the trial back 3 months, and then you yank the carpet out from under them the next morning and say, no, we're going today and without counsel, then sure, there might be interest if it's part of the initial waiver. But when it's imposed the morning after, where you've already crossed that barrier and you've already said, I'm going it alone, period, and then you go, oh, by the way, we're doing this, you can't have reliance on something that happens later. And if there is a reliance, then that would be part of going to knowing intelligent and voluntary, which would be going back to the validity of the waiver question, which is not before the court. Because again, as to the revocation, that's the proposition the court rejected. As to the other part, that was a proposition that was never even raised at the jurisdictional stage and not preserved in the courts below. So all of those are problems. But at the end of the day, I also know counsel referred to that the court could potentially legislate. I think that was a key word there, legislate. We have a legislature. This court isn't it. This court can write rules. And if it's a good policy, it should write rules. But you can't read it into the Sixth Amendment. He chose this at this fork in the road. He can't go the other way and still claim any residual rights to any Sixth Amendment counsel. And without a right to counsel, you can't have counsel do a particular thing, whether it's be here a particular time, give particular advice, meet some particular level. Anytime you require someone to meet even a minimum level, that is a form of the hybrid counsel that this court already rejected in Martin, and that every court around the country in circuit after circuit and state after state has uniformly rejected for good reason. We ask the court to stick to its precedent and to that consensus and reject Jones's claim to manufacture basically a constitutional right out of just a policy idea. Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
As stated, during that, the choices dictate where we are. And in this particular matter, this court chose to give standby counsel to Mr. Jones. In doing so, they created a reliance. This is the same counsel that they had appointed for him. He was crying for a new attorney to do this case for him. They gave him the same attorney that they had previously appointed to him. And then at a critical stage of voir dire, they said, he's not going to be there. We find a problem with that. We find structural error, and we find some bite to get this case remanded.
Counsel, I don't recall. Did the judge give a reason why he didn't have standby at voir dire?
I don't believe there was a reason for that. It was simply stated, your counsel will be available after. And for purposes of the record, at the opening statement, he was also not present where the client didn't know what to do once again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, we call a recess.